Okay, welcome to our new series, which is called Increasing Your Jewish IQ. Now, I can tell you this is something I've always wanted to give a class on. And the thrust of the class is there's a lot of fundamental, basic information and knowledge that every good Jew, or bad Jew for that matter, should know. And because we don't know a lot of the fundamentals, we seem to have a smattering of Jewish knowledge, but it really doesn't, it's not something, as the Torah says in the Shema, v'shinantom livonecha, which we translate, you shall teach it to your children. The Gemara says, v'shinantom means that when your children are asked, they don't stammer, they give immediate answers to the questions. So the knowledge is like that. And that really is the way our Jewish knowledge should be. Not just, oh, yeah, it's something like that, but I'm not exactly sure. It's been a long time since I learned it and that kind of stuff. But rather, this is information you should have on your fingertips. Just like everybody knows certain things, you know, when the Declaration of Independence, if you're an American, you know it's 1776. There's nothing to talk about. Right, if you know what normal temperature the body is, right, I'm still Fahrenheit, 98.6. You don't have to start looking it up. You just know what it is. So in Judaism, you should have the same thing. So I've always felt that that's an important thing, although I've never really given it as a formal class. So it's going to be very interesting for me to present it. And the idea is to try to present it in a way that you will remember it. It's not the idea for me to just share with you lots of information, but I want to find a way to share it in a way that you, if you review, of course, if you just come to the class and you don't even think about it for another week, you're not going to remember anything. But if you do a little bit of review, it should be something that hopefully things will stick, because the mind works in an interesting way. The things that are conducive for the brain to formulate in systems, this is what Luzzatto was famous for, creating systems on Judaism, then it's easier for the mind to retain it. So that's what the hope is. How long this class will take? I have no idea. You know, how much do you want to increase your Jewish IQ? So it can go for a long time. But we'll see. It'll be a little adventure for all of us, okay? And please, if you have any questions, ask them. So I'm wondering, where am I going? Well, first idea I want to share with you, and this is one of the ideas of connecting things. It's a Kabbalistic idea, and it says that all of existence has three dimensions. Three dimensions. And what are they called in mystical terms? Olam, Shana, and Nefesh. Which literally means, Olam means the world, Shana means year, Nefesh means soul. But the way we understand it is space, time, and soul. And therefore, there's certain concepts. A certain concept is understood in terms of space, in terms of time, and in terms of soul. You know, for an example, you know, certain ideas of holiness, right? So certain ideas of holiness, in time, it's Shabbos. In space, it's the Beis HaMikdash. And in soul, it's a tzaddik. So it's the same concept, but those are the three dimensions of that holiness. But you see, once you know one, you know three. So that's what I'm attempting to do in presenting this information as much as humanly possible, to put things in terms of space, time, and soul. And with patience, you'll figure this out. Now, some of this information may be obvious, and some may not, because there's definitely a vast array of people over here. So we're going to start with the simple and then expand out. And I feel that this is all information we should all know. So if we're going to start, let's start from the days of creation. Let's start from the beginning of the Torah. That's the best place to start. That's where the religion begins, is Jewish knowledge begins with the creation of the world. Okay, so the first thing that you should have knowledge, you know, and I really should just close this up and, you know, give you a spot quiz right now, is tell me quickly what was created on all 6 days of creation. Boom, 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 boom. Now, you know if you know it, you know if you don't. So I'm not going to ask you, I don't think everybody can just spew it forth. He said, well, I know between the 6 days, what God, everything got created in the 6 days. But it's important to know what got created on each day. I mean, that's kind of a fundamental idea. All right, so what do we have? So very simply, this is the first thing every Jew should know, exactly what happened on those days. So on the first day of creation, afterwards, a couple of verses of introduction about in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, but that's not day one. And there was a wind hovering over the waters, and there was a deep void, whatever that means. But then when it finally gets to exactly what happened on day one, God said, let there be light. And there was light, although that light will need to be defined because there was no sun yet. But God created light on the first day of creation. On the second day of creation, God separated the upper and lower waters via what the Torah calls a rakia, a firmament. Because we said before creation, there was just water all over, darkness and water all over the place. So then God separated the upper and the lower waters via a firmament. That was day two. Day three, water and land were separated, and the vegetable kingdom was created. Okay, day four, the sun, the moon, and stars were created. Okay, day five, birds and sea creatures were created. Day six, the animal kingdom was created, including the first man, Adam and Chava, created in the divine image. And the seventh day was Shabbos, a cessation of work. That you should have like this. You shouldn't have to think about that. That should be as clear as day. I should wake up in the middle of the night and I say fifth day of creation and you say birds and fish. Finished. Okay, that's level one. We're calling this days of creation round one. Okay? Yes, already. Good.
What is the upper waters? What do you
mean? I'm sorry?
What do you mean by upper waters?
There were waters on the simple level. There was water everywhere. Just where whatever existence was water. Then God created the heavens. And now there's water on the other side of the heavens, believe it or not. And there's water down here. Okay? You don't have to understand everything perfectly because some things are beyond our understanding. But that's a simple, simple meaning. That shouldn't that, we all agree that everybody should know this? Mm-hmm. Yes? Okay, so perhaps let's look at it from a different way, and maybe this will help us to remember. So we want to find ways to help us remember. I hope this will help you remember and not give you more problems, that there's more things you have to remember on top of it. But I hope this will help. All right, let's look at what types of elements of creation exist. Maybe that's something we all know. Fire, water, earth, and air. Everything is made up from fire, water, earth, and air. Is that an easier thing to remember? Okay. So let's look at days of creation, round two, based on fire, water, earth, and air, with the basis of a medrash. The medrash says each day of creation had a partner, except for the seventh day. Seventh day said, I have no partner. Hashem said, don't worry, the Jewish people will be your partner. Okay, so now the question is, which days were partnered with which day? You have 6 days, you have three partners. What were the partners? So let's hold on to that thought for a minute, and let's introduce another piece of Talmud. There's a fact that the prophets instituted the Torah readings on Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos. That was the prophets is referring to Moshe Rabbeinu. And when did this happen? This happened when we were in the desert and Amalek attacked us at Rephidim and we had gone 3 days without water / Torah. So therefore, Moshe instituted that we should read from the Torah publicly. So we'll be studying Torah Monday, Thursday, and Shabbos, because that way 3 days don't elapse. But that should spark a question. What question should you ask? Why does it have... Well, Shabbos, we understand why we read on Shabbos, because nobody's working on Shabbos. But if you want to go 3 days without reading, what are your other options? Does it have to be Monday and Thursday? What if it was Tuesday and Thursday? Would you not accomplish the same goal? And you can't say, well, Tuesday's only, you know, one day in between Tuesday and Thursday. Well, it's only one day between Thursday and Shabbos. How about Monday and Wednesday? Right? Why was it Monday and Thursday? Isn't that an interesting question? Okay, that's the second thing. And of course, as we mentioned, the Torah is compared to the positive life-giving source of water. Water gives you life. Torah is compared in the positive way. It's compared to water. The more Torah you learn, the Talmud tells us that a Jew without Torah is like a fish out of water. When a fish is out of water, it will certainly die. If it's in the water, maybe the fisherman will catch him, maybe he won't. But if he's out of the water, he will certainly die. If a Jew studies Torah, an anti-Semite might kill us for learning Torah, might not kill us for learning Torah. But one thing's for sure, if a Jew does not study Torah, he will spiritually die. That's all there is to it. Okay, now we have this information may help us understand that, okay, we have four basic elements, fire, water, earth, wind, right? So we can remember that. We could see that this is the pattern of the 6 days of creation. Okay, and the partners are Sunday and Wednesday, Monday and Thursday, Tuesday and Friday, first day with the fourth day, second day with the fifth day, third day with the sixth day. What makes them partners? What makes them partners is they have a commonality between them. Well, if you can just remember that the first day is a fire day, then the fourth day is a fire day because it's a partner with it. Second day is a water day. Well, the fifth day will be a partner with it as a water day. The third day is an earth day. So the sixth day will be its partner as an earth day. And then we have that seventh day where I don't know, I could use the word air, wind, same thing, interchangeable. And Shabbos had no partner, so it's air, it's wind. Okay? Well, how does that fit in over here? Well, very nicely. What happened on the first day of creation? Light. Light is fire. Right? What happened on the second day of creation? Something to do with water. He separated the higher and the lower waters. So that's water. What was the third day? The dry land came into being. That's earth. Fire, water, earth. All right, fourth day, fire is sun, the moon, and the stars. That's fire, right? Fifth day, a little trickier. Water, what's the water there? The fish, the sea creatures, and the birds, the Talmud says, were a combination of water and mud. It was like mud, and from the mud came the birds as well. So it's a water day, but the fish is a lot easier to remember, but the birds also have a certain aquatic nature to them, similarly, so that becomes the water. And finally, on the sixth day, earth, where does earth fit in there? Well, man comes came from the dust and returns from the dust, and the man and the other beasts of the wild are also come from the earth. So very nice, fire, water, earth. Right, the Shabbos is nothing but wind, air, spirituality, has no partner. So who is the partner? Partner is the Jewish people who have a divine soul, which is called a ruach, the wind, air, as it were, ethereal type of nature. And that's the Jewish people are the partner of the Shabbos. All right, so that is another way of looking at the 6 days of creation and the Shabbos, and perhaps that's a way to help you remember those days better. Okay, so we've taken the elements of creation, the basic elements, and tied them into the 6 days of creation. Okay, now we're going to take it to a whole nother level now. And we're going to get to something, although it's Kabbalistic by nature, but every Jew needs to know a certain amount of pragmatic Kabbalah as basic common knowledge. Because if you don't know it, you don't understand so many things that you're doing. And it makes things easier to remember. Now, I'll admittedly say that is going to take a little work to remember, but this is something that just comes over and over and over and over. So you might as well get it once right. And I'm not expecting you to remember this all by next week, but if you're, some of you have no knowledge of it, some of you have some knowledge, some have more, but the more you're exposed to it, the more you understand it, and if you understand the logic of it, it fits in. So obviously, you see what I got in my notes coming up. You're going to see it in a minute. We're going to come to Days of Creation, Round 3, and then we're going to come to Days of Creation, Historical, Round 4. So where we're going to start tying in the 6 days of creation to the entire creation of the world. You see, everything ties in, but you need to have the tools that tie them in together. All right? So that's where I feel this Kabbalistic part may help us. Okay. So there's a general notion in Kabbalah of some, and I don't get hung up on these heavy terms, okay, but there's an idea of what's called the five partsufim, the five faces. And basically, and that becomes the basis for what we'll talk about afterwards, the ten sephiros. Okay, now sephiros, and it's a good time to talk about sephiros because we're in a period of time that's called Sefirat HaOmer, where we're counting the Omer. And that is a thing we're doing every day, and that is very relevant. And let's just, by way of introduction, know that what's the purpose of creation? The purpose of creation is to man, for God to bestow pleasure upon mankind. And the way that God can bestow the greatest pleasure on mankind is for mankind to cleave to the source of existence, which is God. And a human being can only cleave to God if he is able to emulate the Creator in the way that a human being is possible. That is the root source of being able to have the greatest pleasure in life. Okay, so how can a human being emulate the Creator if we don't understand anything about the Creator? Can anybody tell me where you're going to find the Creator and how you can describe him? So we're told that we cannot describe what God is, but we can very well describe what God does. And if we know what God does vis-a-vis his relationship with planet Earth and the people on planet Earth, then we can emulate what God does, emulate his quote-unquote characteristics, and have a relationship with him. Okay, now let me just start off by saying that whenever we talk about God's characteristics, I'm telling you right up front, we want to fall into a trap of Christianity. That is not a definition of God's essence per se, but rather how God manifests his relationship with mankind. Very important rule. Every Jew needs to know that too. There's the essential nature of God, which is undescribable and unknowable. That's from the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh name of God. But then there's Bereshis Bara Elohim. Hashem created a concept of Elohim, a God that can relate, that chooses to relate to us, chooses to behave in a way that we can discern and we can try to emulate and cleave to that aspect of Hashem. To give a simple analogy, if you would want Albert Einstein to have a relationship with his two-year-old grandchild, how is he going to have a... Now, we know that Einstein can start whipping up equations covering up a blackboard. And if he starts talking to the two-year-old like that, he'll have absolutely no relationship with that two-year-old. So what does Einstein do? He goes on all fours, and he pretends he's a doggy, and he goes woof, woof to the kid, and the kid has a great time, and he loves his grandfather. Now, anybody looking at that situation saying, I don't understand, Einstein has just gone out of his mind. Too many equations over here, and he's going woof, woof to the kid. The answer is, no, the woof, woof is not Einstein. That Einstein, that's Einstein, is unknowable to the two-year-old. But woof, woof is very knowable to the child. And now he has a relationship with the grandchild. The grandchild has a relationship with him. And it all works out nice, but the grandchild does not have no idea what Einstein really is. Same thing with God. Compare Einstein to God. It's so far away. God essentially is unknowable. But God created, as it were, an aspect of himself that woof-woofs with the world below here in a more sophisticated way than that, and we can discern God's quote-unquote characteristics that we are meant to emulate. Okay? And that really is what the 10 Sefiros are about. And that should be common knowledge for a Jew, to know the 10 Sefiros. And at least on a simple level, what they mean. Sefira comes from the word to count. That means something's in a measured unit. Sefira also means something that shines. And what God did, God is an infinite being. If God would send his infinite energies into the world, he'd blow us apart with all that infinite energy. So we had to kind of cut it down and measure it in certain ways that mankind can tolerate and can understand and then emulate in that. Am I making any sense here? Am I getting too off the deep end over here? Okay, so it's a really important thing for us to know what God's 10 Sefiros are. That should be basic Jewish knowledge that, unfortunately, when you're going through high school, they never teach any of this stuff to you. And then you don't understand what's going on. But I think if you have this, so many things connect. You're looking for connectors. The more things that connect, the more you can understand. They all fall in. For example, how many tens do you know in the Torah? Just offhand. How many tens do you know?
Ten commandments.
Ten tests of Avram. No? One more, at least. Just had paid. Ten plagues.
And ten spies?
What?
The spies were?
Well, there are 12 spies. Okay. Ten were bad, two were good. But there's a lot of tens, and they're all going to relate to this idea, as you'll see in a minute. So before we can get to the ten, really the 10 can also be shrunken down to 5. And the reason I want to do the 5 is because I want to make it easier for you to remember. I know you're thinking, he's not making it easy, he's giving me more information. But if you think of it logically, the mind works, it remembers things that connect. If I just give you random facts and nothing's connecting, you can't remember anything. But if I give you ideas that connect, at least the brain has a chance. For some of us at my age, even then, the brain is quite challenged. But at least we have a chance. So there's something called the 5 faces of God's relationship. And number of them are the Sefiros themselves. But the 5 really makes it work really nice. And those are called Keser, Chochma, Bina, the 6 edges of Tiferes and Malchus. Okay, now I'm going to make it real easy to understand this. I'm trying to make this Kabbalah for beginners. Okay, imagine that you want to do anything in life, to build a house, to lose weight, to be successful in business, you name it, okay, anything in life must go, if you want to succeed, must go through 5 stages. And this is logical, that's what I'm saying, everything's logical. So there's 5 stages. We call them Keser, Chachma, Bina, 6 edges of Tiferes and Malchus. So what does that mean? So let's give a simple example. You want to, now you just won the lottery, and you would like to build yourself an amazing, no, you didn't win the lottery. Let's say you want to build yourself a home. You win the lottery, it's not going to be a good example. You want to build yourself a home. Okay, what are the steps necessary to build a home? There's 5 steps. It's always got to be in this order also. Getting approved, you're way down the line. Way down the line. First one is called the will. You got to want to have a house. I want to have a house. What if there is no will to have a house? You know, the wife goes to the husband and says, you know, we need to build a house. And the husband says, yeah, okay, fine. But he really doesn't want to build a house. Is it ever going to happen?
No.
It's not going to happen. You got to really want it. You have to really want something. You don't even know for sure what it's going to look like. But you want something. The will. Now, what does the word keter mean? It's a crown. Where does the crown sit? On top of your brains. It sort of say, circumscribes, I think that's the word, right? Goes around the brain. So it's kind of just like a king when he's got the crown on. You know, what does that say? His will is to rule over his people, right? And it surrounds the head. Meaning, what is he thinking about? Everything that's inside that crown. He's not thinking of going to a Maple Leafs game, really. A good king isn't thinking about that. He's got much more important things. He's got to defend the country against the borders. He has to bring enough economic growth to the country. He doesn't have time for Mishigasim. So his will is, now what do you know about, what do you know about a will? The Talmud says, nothing stands against an indefatigable will. If you really want something, you'll get it. There's no such thing. What they say, when there's a will, there's a way. If you really want something, you can get it. Don't say, I don't know. That just means I don't want. I'll try. What do you mean you'll try? That means you don't care. If you will it, it's going to be. By hook or by crook, you're going to make it happen. Now, of all the human beings on the planet, who has a will that's least unstoppable? I know it's up. Wake up. You're supposed to hit the thing, Chanuch. This happens from time to time. Oh, I know why. It's my thing. You know why I did that happen? Because I didn't touch it enough. Okay. Anyway, who has the greatest will that can't be stopped? A king! The Talmud says a Jewish king is able to do whatever he wants. He can do whatever he wants. If he wants to go through someone's private property, he could just take it because the army has to go through it. He wants to take what he can do. He has every resource, whatever he wants. So the king has an unstoppable will. That's why we call that first level the Keser. That's the will. Now, that's easy to remember, isn't that? Crown on your head. You're the king. You have power. The will. So what's your will? I want to have a home. To the degree you want to have the home, you'll have the home. And more than that, every other step is infused with that will. And that keeps the other steps going. The will is weak, nothing else is going to happen. We all understand that? Does that make sense? Okay, so now what's the next step? Okay, now I want to build a home. Okay, what's the next step? Well, what kind of home you go? I have no idea. I don't know what's out there on the market. You know, we've just started a little bit of renovations in our house, you know, to make a new bathroom. You think I know how to make a new bathroom? I think I know what's on the market. So you what do? You research. You collect information. And the more information you have, the more knowledge you have, the more wisdom you have, the more you're in a position to make a decision, wouldn't you say? So you get a whole bunch of magazines, you know, that tell you, you know, you can have a 4-bedroom house, a 5-bedroom house, en suites, this, that, attached garage, not attached garage, jacuzzis, a place. Oh, there's all kinds of things. You got to know what's out there. You got to know what's out there. Then you got to find out some other information, like cost. Cost. And then you're busy collecting information. So that's the second step, chachma. The information as it relates to what your will is about. It's all very logical. If you gotta remember this after tonight, then this, you know, you got some issues because this is like very logical, right? Once you hear it, you just can't forget it. Okay, so I went through 6 months of information gathering. So now what has to be the next step? You got to make a decision. What's the plan? Okay, now that I got all that information, okay, probably the first and most important information, how much money do you have to spend? It's probably the most important. So let's say you have $1 million, and Thornhill will not get you very far. Okay, but anyway, you got $1 million. And with that, you've decided you're going to not build in Toronto. Was there any another decision where? And somewhere in the sticks. Okay, you've decided an 8-bedroom home with en suites and this and that and all these things. And that is now taking all that information and deducing from that information, building on that information, coming up with a plan. This is what I'm going to do. Now remember, if the will was weak, they're not going to be so clear in the information gathering. They may not gather that much information, and the project may stop right at the information gathering part. If there's not a strong will, you may not ever come up with a plan. But now you come up with a plan. All right? That's step number three. The next thing is very obvious. It's what? Action. Start working the plan. And there's six edges of that, which we'll elaborate on shortly. Okay, make sense? Okay, you start hiring workers, and you're watching the workers, and this and that and all these things. Yet there's still one more step, and with this, without this step, the whole thing can fall apart. And what's that? Is to keep your eye on the goal. You got to always remember it, what the goal is. What is that final product? Now, the goal is very much connected to the will. Very much connected. The will was, I wanted a nice house that I could live in. But that was so
general.
But at the end of the day, I want a nice place where I can hang my hat and my coat, be warm and comfortable, and feel that's my palace. You had no idea what it's going to look like. Now you have a sharper idea what it's going to look like, but now you got to make sure that you're still going to make sure that goal is reached. Now, there's this business concept of waste in production. You know, that you have these great plans, and then somehow you get these amazing cost overruns that you never planned on. And why was that? Is it because as production is happening, you're losing sight of the goal. Mm-hmm. You forget about certain things in the goal, and then you do things in the wrong order. Like, again, I'm not a builder, so don't hold me to what I'm saying here. It could be totally wrong. But I think the first thing you would do is build a foundation. You know, probably the first thing you'll build a foundation. You wouldn't start on the main floor. And then, you know, can you imagine you built the first floor. It says, oh, I forgot about the foundation. You know, it's not going to work. So, you know, if you have an idea of what the goal is, you're going to have the foundation. And then you're going to do the what do you call it, the framing. No, and of course you're not going to, after you've painted the house, you're not going to start putting the plumbing in, right? You're going to put the plumbing in somewhere after the framing and before the tiling and this and that. And I think the last thing you do is paint. I don't know. I could be wrong, but I think painting is the last thing. And if you lose sight of the goal, right, you're going to have all kinds of mistakes are going to happen. And with all the best of intentions, you know, you may not get that house at all. You got to keep that eye on the goal. Okay, this is for anything in life. Tell me anything in life you want to succeed in that doesn't work that will work if you don't do these five things. You want to lose weight? Same thing. You want to open up a business? Same thing. How about you want to get married? You're single again? Same thing. Right? Tell me anything in life you want to do. You got to go through these processes. Now, how do we know that? We know that from the Creator, because He made something called planet Earth. And when He made planet Earth, now God didn't need to do any of this. He could do like, you know, I'm bewitched, wiggle His saintly nose, and the whole world comes into being. He could have done that, but then we wouldn't have learned anything from it. But rather, He went through a step-by-step process for our benefit to emulate Him. Okay, you with me on this? You're still in the game? Okay, and that's what Pirkei Avos says. The world was created with 10 utterances. It says, Vayomer, and God said 9 times. And the word Bereishis is the 10th time. So God used, now we go from the 5 faces. So the faces are clear. That this is clear, right? Everybody got this clear?
Yes.
So now we're just going to expand the 5 into 10. And where's the expansion going to happen? At point 4, the 6 edges of Tiferes. There are 6 action steps. So all I've done is I've taken the 5, and step 4 expands into 6. Okay. Which leads us to the discussion of the 10 spheros. Okay. Which, again, is very basic Jewish knowledge that everybody should know, even though it's Kabbalistic in nature, and it's really crazy Kabbalah, but we're going to keep it for the layman very simple, and I'm trying not to overcomplicate things. Okay, so when we look at the 10 spheros, You just got to know these. It just, there's nothing else to talk about. You got to know these. So we call what we call the higher spheros, the higher spheros. There's three that are the higher spheros. And seven call the lower spheros. They're called the midos. Three and seven is ten. To make it simpler, where do you find them? Okay, now again, these are God's characteristics. When God created the first human being, he created the human being with a soul, and that soul was capable of manifesting those ten divine qualities. Every Jewish person has a soul that has these ten qualities within it. Isn't that important for a person? Shouldn't a Jew know he has those ten characteristics?
Yeah.
It was found in first man. It was found in unique individuals during the first 20 generations after creation. It was not to everybody. And from Abraham on, and certainly at Sinai, it's the exclusive domain of the Jewish people. That we have a divine soul that carries within it the same substance, as it were, although to a lesser degree, the ten spheros within the human being. And they're called the midos and the spheros as such. So we're going to be straddling. We're going to be talking about God. So I'm just showing you where this is going to go now. So we're going to have the ten utterances, which is the ten spheros. So we're going to look at the ten steps of how God created the world. And then we're going to, what are we going to do? We're going to take the lower seven, and what are we going to plug them into? What do you think we're going to plug them into? What's going to be the logical next step if we're talking about creation? We've got three higher and seven lower. So what am I going to plug the seven lower into? What do you think? Take a wild guess. 7 days of creation. Wouldn't that make sense? Right? And every day manifested another characteristic. Isn't that exciting? And in a minute we'll see that Ramban learns that the 6 days of creation are millennial, and they represent 1,000 years of Jewish history. Whatever happened in day one is going to tell us what's going to happen for the first 1,000 years of history. And what happened on day two is the second millennia of history. And they're all going to follow the spheros again. So you're beginning to see how I'm mixing time, place, and soul all together. I'm just going to get at where we're going so you don't surprise you and your mind is ready to make the right links. So therefore, where I got to start from? I got to start, you always got to start from God. That's where it starts. And if God exhibits these characteristics in the creation of the world, it would be good for us to know how that exhibits, just on a simple level. And then man is made to emulate, and then we can see history following that period. Okay, we may not finish everything tonight. You know, I'm only good halfway through. That's fine. It'll be less for you to remember for next week. Okay, so when we're talking about the higher spheres, they're starting from God, but they will manifest within the human being. And you'll see later on my handy-dandy chart. Later on, it's going to show you where they all fit into the name, the quality, the body part you have. We'll get to the questions on the final exam when you leave this world. God happens to have 10 questions he asks you when you go up to the next world that you could cheat and you can cram before the test. So you'll know what to do. That's also another important thing every Jew should know. It also happens to be 10 questions, 10 spheros. Look at all these coincidences. Yeah. So anyway, so that's why it's important that we get the 10 spheros at least on some rudimentary level. Okay, I know you're going to want to go deeper, but we've got to keep it on a rudimentary level. So now where am I at? The higher and the lower ones. Okay, so the first three, we will just call them for a simple, they're intellectual characteristics. They'll manifest in the human brain. That's God doesn't have a brain, so to speak, but they will call it the intellectual qualities based on what the intellect dictates, behavior will follow. Character will follow. So God, again, who didn't need to do this, but these are the three. The first three, I've kind of already told you what they are because they're not much different than the faces. They're the exact same names of the faces. Okay, so let's just quickly review. So these, by now, you have a few things you should be remembering. So Kesser is what?
Crown.
Is the crown. So it's God infinite. What was God's will? We're talking about Kesser, the crown. So what was God's? This is before the world is even on anything. Before he brought the crew to construct. What was God's will? What was God's will? Anybody want to try? Just whatever you guess is fine.
Relationship with man.
Well, let's start from the beginning. To create a world. Wouldn't that be a... Well, no, you might be right. To create, to bestow kindness. God is kind. It's the nature of a kind being to be kind. And a little problem. There's nobody to be kind to. So he has this idea. Now, don't ask me why he has ideas. You know, you're not allowed to ask questions before creation. Because what does God need to create a world for? He can be fine without a world. Well, that's philosophy beyond what we're ready for, just increasing your Jewish IQ. Okay, but God had this infinite will to bestow kindness to mankind. So that's generating all everything else he's going to do. Everything that he does afterwards is to achieve this goal. And the term we shoot around is to bestow his kindness, and that man, or the recipient. Now, God has to decide who's the recipient going to be. Is it going to be a horse, a mule, or a human being? So God has to decide, you know, what he's going to create to be the beneficiary of that. It's all part of the, again, I'm using very humanistic terms that are totally inappropriate to use for God, but we're just using it vis-a-vis his relationship with the world. I've emphasized this so many times that I don't want Adrian to walk out as a Christian. Okay? Oh. And giving God human qualities. We cannot do that. But vis-a-vis mankind, he behaves that way so we can behave back with him. I may say it 10 more times in the next few weeks because I don't want you to walk out with this mistake. Okay? But so we talk, the word that's used for this great gift and for man to receive it, the Kabbalistic term, what do you think it's going to be? Light. Light is clarity. You see it. You benefit from it. Warmth. Understanding. That all, that's light. You know, I see the light. You see the light when you're connecting to Hashem. That is the buzzword, light. Okay? So that was the Kesser. And God is certainly the king. No question about it. So there was this will. This will is to share his essence with mankind. Would that not be a good beginning starting point? And that's that first couple lines before it gets into real creation. Bereshis, in the beginning. It's not in the beginning. We know it doesn't mean beginning. It's always for Reshis, for the purpose of the Jewish people, for the purpose of the Torah, for certain purposes. So that's all, quote unquote, going through God's mind, although you can't use those terms. Before he ever does anything, it's going through his mind. He's got this Kesser. Okay. Till we get to that desired objective. So, step number two. So that's like above the mind, almost, as it were, right? Then we get into chachma. Chachma is a combination of two words. The letters in Hebrew, koach ma. If you rearrange the letters, chachma is koach ma. Koach means potential. Ma means what is. So chachma means the potential of what is. Or the potential to be. Okay? And chachma, if you want to use a very specific term, again, it's so God, as it were, goes through the possibilities of how am I going to get this light to a beneficiary who's going to take advantage of that light, as it were. Okay? So therefore, it's the chachma is defined as that, like that first little germ of highly condensed revelation of God's light in the highest level of eminence that he wants to send it down to the world, but he still has to figure a way to package it and send it down. Again, he doesn't need to figure it out, but he's going through the processes. So that's the chachma, God's wisdom, as it were. How more, they give the analogy as well as the mystics say, it's like the great depths below. You see these words of the depths with this huge waters underneath, aquifers that are underneath that are trying to get higher and higher. So that's the will to make the world full of water. So then you need something like a spring to shoot it out a little bit. It still doesn't have any direction and any focus, but that could be like the chachma. It's like, let's get it out. But then let's try to get a little more focus, and we come to number three, bina, which terribly translated in English is understanding. It's really good if you just learn the Hebrew words and forget about the English. The English will only distort any understanding you'll have of this. The word bina comes from the word lifnos, to build. or to be able to deduce from the facts what should come out from the facts. Okay? Okay? So, therefore, we take the abstract, non-dimensional, incomprehensible. Oh, I want to make it happen, but I got all these ideas, and we want to sharpen it. So we take that initial chachma, we expand it into something that's clear and concrete. Using our analogy, you got the great depths of water below, you got the little spring coming out, and now we form a river that's putting a direction as to where the water is going to go. Okay, so we have Keser, Chachma, and Bina. Okay, if you want to hear another analogy, the relationship of Chachma and Bina, it's, let's say, a drop of semen, which potentially contains lives of hundreds of people and thousands of people. That's like the Chachma. And the womb, which receives the drop of sperm, is analogous to Bina, which expands and builds on that till something exactly comes out of there. Or another analogy is a person walking in a dark place where he's unfamiliar. Suddenly a flash of lightning is there. You see the whole area for an instant. The moment later, it's dark. Now you got to find your way home and try to reconstruct that brief revelation to make something happen. So this is the three first steps, Keser, Chochma, Bina. That's how they manifest in God. How they're going to manifest in humans, that's going to be a step later down the line. Okay? Keser, Chochma, Bina. There's another one that you'll hear. It's called Da'as. So I don't want to get too complicated here, but Keser is from God's perspective, so to speak, and Da'as is from man's perspective. Don't get overly worried about that. If you just either, you know, Keser Chochma Bina or Chochma Bina Das, which is the acronym of Chabad. Now you know where Chabad comes from. They didn't just pick a word Chabad. It's Chochma Bina Das. Ches Beis Dalet is Chabad. Okay, in human perspective, we say like this. Oh, let's give another simple example of Chochma Bina and Das. Okay, how does a human being use Chochma Bina and Das? Okay, you're getting a lot of information about research into lung cancer and smoking. And you're collecting all this information, all these studies. That's a lot of information out there. Chachma, that's wisdom. All these longitudinal studies. You got the information. That's Chachma. Now, what do you do with that information? How do you build on that information? That's Bina. You know, you now have come to the conclusion that there is a direct relationship between smoking and cancer. That's Bina. You had to do something with that information, right? Now, what would be the logical next step for a chain smoker? Stop smoking. Now, you then would need those next seven steps to act the plan. But there's still one more thing that the human being needs that God doesn't need. In other words, God has Keser. We don't necessarily have Keser as much as we need this next thing, Das. Das means to live in the reality of what Chachma and Bina just told you. In other words, not to have just an intellectual understanding, but it's got to be real. In other words, it's got to be so real that when you look at a cigarette, you see cancer in the cigarette. You see it. It's mamish there. It's not just a theory. It's cancer. I'm putting cancer inside of me. I can't do that. That's living in the reality of what you know. Okay, that's Das. Okay, so, you know, we kind of say it in the mystics, you know, you always have the top three. You got three out of the four. Either we go Keser, Chochma, Bina. When God can start with a will, he doesn't have to work on his will. It's a little harder for us to work on our will, to have to know what our will is at all. Well, we get a will the backwards. We go through Chochma Bina, and then we get Das, and that becomes our will. So that they're kind of interchangeable. Don't get too hung up. But you basically have three on the top. It's in the brain. You don't see anything going on. At this point in creation, there's nothing to be seen. God's just, you know, he's thinking. And he says, well, how am I going to get the water to get to a stream and this and that? I'm going to finally, till it's going to happen. Okay. Now, we got to now work on those six edges. The action plan. And that now takes us now to what we call the lower spheros, and they're called midos. Mido literally in Hebrew means a measurement. Okay? And these seven spheros work to precise measurements in order to work properly. Okay, with me? So maybe to make this a little more interesting, as time is fleeting, what I initially thought is to go through all of them, but I might, well, what we'll do is we'll take one at a time and tie it into a day of creation. So you're going to get the tie-in. I think that might work a little better, because I've overwhelmed you with seven mitos. It's going to be hard. Okay, but you're with me so far? So we got the will, we got the possibilities, we got the game plan, and now it's time for action. Same thing with God. He had the will, the possibilities. It's interesting, a Medrash says, I don't remember the number, God created like thousands of worlds and destroyed them. Thousands of worlds and destroyed until he came up with this world. Now, of course, God's not a trial and error kind of God, but what the Medrash is trying to show us is there were a lot of different possibilities of how God could have created a world. The way it would just work out best, you know, with free will choice and reward and punishment and the ability to cleave to God. It's very complicated, this world. So God, just for the heck of it, you know, just says, you know, I just want you to know it's not so simple to make such a world. And there could be a lot of, so to speak, why is God doing that? So when we try projects and fail, we'll say, listen, God didn't do so good either in the beginning, and he stuck with it for a while. God does things for us to emulate him. Again, not that it has to be that way. You understand? As a parent, you may purposely fail in front of your children just so you could succeed afterwards, so they could learn to do the same thing. Don't you ever do that? No, I'm perfect. I'm a parent, right? No. Of course, you would purposely do certain things so the kid would learn from that, right? You know, don't you, when you play with the kid, don't you purposely lose to him sometimes so he feels he's only, yeah, but you could smear him. So Hashem does the same thing. Okay, I tried a few thousand times. The worlds didn't work out. That was the range of power. This kind of world isn't good. This kind of world. No, this world with human beings and flesh and blood and this and air and gravity and all these things. That's the perfect. I finally got the recipe right. Now they got the recipe right. Let's go and make it happen. But this all is relevant to us as well. Okay, so let's take a look at first attribute. Now we're talking about the lower spheros. That's the mitos. That's the characteristics in action. Okay? So, we start with number one, chesed, is kindness or benevolence. It denotes an unbounded loving kindness. Unmitigated. It's nothing about anything but just giving. It's also connoted with the word love. And that's what God created the world, the Psalms say, Olam chesed yibana, the world was created with kindness. The whole purpose of creation was for kindness, and God starts with the first energy flow, the first construction, the first step of anything you want to do in life. Again, going back to all these things, you want to lose weight, you got to start with kindness, not with harshness. They say, I love myself. I love myself so much. I want myself to have the best of everything in life. And that starts with good health. And therefore, I will stop smoking. I will not overeat. Or I love myself. I'm going to build myself the nicest house. Because I love myself. Or I love you, and I'm going to do something for you. It's not only just selfish. I want to buy Alwyn a house. Because I love Alwyn, and I want to give him the most I could give him. Right? But, oh, I'm sorry, Shlomo. Slicha. I'm sorry. Okay. But that any behavior. You see, God, why did God create the world? Because he wanted to give us kindness. So the first act is kindness. Anything you do in life should start with this vision, first well thought out, and it's going to start with kindness. God's nature is absolute benevolence and loving kindness. He created the world so he could bestow kindness. As the Kabbalists say, it's the nature of he who is good to do good. And we're in God's image. Don't ever forget. Whatever I'm saying about God, we have to play the party line on that too as well. Okay, so that means the first day of creation has got to be filled with unmitigated kindness. Unmitigated kindness. So what was created on the first day of creation? Let there be light. This is not the standard light that you could see with, because no sun was created yet. It's not a physical light. It's a spiritual light, okay? And the rabbis say that light, whatever it means, it shined from one end of the creation to the other. So, or in the language of the Kabbalists, in the beginning, an infinite, uncompounded light filled all of creation. This is the light of kindness that permeates all of creation and through which all of creation was built. Does that not make sense? Now that Sunday is forever a day of kindness. So you start your week with kindness. Well, some people, now remember, I'm not going to go there now, not for life, but for every good attribute, you can misdirect it. It's a whole other discussion. So really, Sunday is the beginning of the week. You're going to figure, I'm going to be kind. But don't make a mistake. Yeah, I'm going to be kind to myself first and sleep until 11 o'clock. You wonder why people sleep until 11 o'clock. Because it's a day of kindness. And when kindness is misdirected, kindness is an other-focused characteristic. When God was kind, was, oh, I want to be kind to myself. I create a world. No, I'm going to be kind to others and give them the best that they can have. It's all about others. So when you're going to use it, it's all about others. But if you take that and just make one wee little change, instead of sending it out, I'm sending it in. So instead of getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning on Sunday and doing chesed to other people like you should on a Sunday, you sleep until 11 to give yourself kindness. And that's a misdirection of that. Do you see that? So do you now see why the first day of creation has to be light? Because that's the light. Now, the rabbi said, this was so good. This light was so delicious. The world would not be worthy to enjoy this for a while, so God had to hide it later. And only the righteous are going to enjoy that. It's just too good. God didn't want to get into the wrong hands. But that's that light. So you see how this all fits in. Day one, light. First attribute of the seven lower spheros is chesed. Chesed is kindness. The light is the kindness. Well, let's jump to make it full circle. I know you're going to love this. So let's jump to my millennial calendar. You're going to put, we're going to get all three streams. Time, what do you call it? Time, space, and soul. All unwrapped on one. So the Talmud says like this. The world is to exist 6,000 years. 2,000 years of desolation. We'll get into that. 2,000 years of Torah, and the last 2,000 years are called the Messianic Era, which means it's possible the Messiah could have come at any time from the year 4001. So it's about 1,700 years late. But that was the earliest we could have it. Ramban, his very famous Ramban, every day of creation represents 1,000 years of world history, because King Solomon says, for God, 1,000 years is like a day. So what God was doing in creation was telling us what the whole world is going to look like for the next 6,000 years. You can look at the following analogy. The 6 days of creation was God putting a compact disc into planet Earth, as it were, and that put 6 discs into the world. And on day one, he put a disc of 1,000 years of existence. And the same thing with all 6 days. He put in 6,000 years of existence each day. So if we know something about day one, we'll know something about the next 1,000 years of world history. So you see how this class is combining facts, mysticism, time, place, history, all in one thing. Easier to remember, I hope. So let's look at the first 1,000 years of creation. We'll call it 0 to 1,000. I put the secular dates over there. So this is light. This is kindness. Where is there kindness in the first 1,000 years of world history? It's basically the millennium of Adam. Now, Adam was the light of the world. Was the light of the world. Now, and when the world was still saturated with knowledge of its creator, because Adam was created by God. Who knew God better than the person created by God? So there was a great knowledge, but at the same time, what was happening during these 1,000 years didn't take too many generations till corruption came in, idol worship came in, and people were being terrible. Now, what would you think should happen when people are terrible? And there's a concept of reward and punishment. People should have got annihilated, but nope, because it's a day of complete kindness. was 1,000 years of complete kindness. God, no matter how bad they were, he just kept showering them with blessings. You know, you planted a tree once, you didn't have to plant for hundreds of years. It was the blessings were unbelievable because God figured maybe if I love them, they're going to come around. Right? And people lived long and healthy lives. You go through the book of Genesis. This one lived 842 years, and this one lived 794 years, and Mr. Shelach lived 900 and what was that? 83, I don't remember. Almost 1,000 years. Adam himself lived 930 years. Did I say 7? Yeah, 930 years. He would have lived 1,000, but he gave 70 to King David. When he saw that King David would die of childbirth, he gave him 70 years. So you see how this all fits in to Chesed is the light of the first day. Easy to remember the first day now with more depths. And now you know the first 1,000 years of Jewish history all for the same price. So let's go back. Got room for maybe one more attribute. Gvura. Gvura, what did I do? Yes. What, Gvura, we will call, and did I give a definition here? One second. Yes. Power. Restrictive power. Control. Being able to control, a simple example, Gvura, catching a criminal. A criminal wants to do bad things, so you catch him. You restrict him, and this is for a good thing. For a good thing, you're restricting. And let's do it in terms of, let's say, Ezel HaGibor, Pirkei Avos, who is a Gibor, a mighty person. Gvura comes from mighty power. Is what? HaKoveshes Yitzro, someone who controls his inclination. What are you doing when you're controlling your inclination? Your inclination wants to do have a good time, wants to give you a lot of chesed at someone else's expense, and you hold it back. Gvura is just the opposite. Chesed is expansive, expansion. Vur is contraction. And that's really what the world's about. Expansion and contraction. First expand, then contract. So, let's see what now. So we're starting off with chesed. Chesed is infinite and unlimited from God. Just everything, right? But that's an infinite giving, but to finite creatures. If God would send everything he has to send from what he's got in his arsenal, us finite beings could not be physical creatures. We'd get blown apart by the spirituality. So God had to hold back some of that kindness. Had to hold it back. We call that tzimtzum, constrainments. So chesed is controlled and limited by the gvura, and that's what we call restrictive power. The power to limit and conceal the infinite light to the degree that every creature can receive it according to the capacity and not get blinded by the light. So it comes out this gevura is an aspect of God's kindness, because if God throws all the kindness at us, he blows us out of the water, we'd be instantly nullified by the infinite kindness. Therefore, he holds it back. Right, so therefore, the sphere of Gvura is the manifestation of God's power to restrict and conceal the light so we can receive it. Does that make a little sense? In terms of human qualities, you're a parent. What's the first thing you should feel to your child? Love. I want to give them everything. You want to feel that way. You want to feel that way. You'd like to do that, but what do you know is going to happen if you're going to give them everything they want? You will destroy them. And therefore, you must then, because you love them, very important. Now, remember, chesed comes before gvura, not the opposite. That not gvura, I brought in the world to control you, and I'll throw in a little chesed here and there. No. It all starts with kindness, and everything starts with kindness. And therefore, when the child says, can I have another candy? And you already gave him three. You're going to be restrictive. No. Oh, you hate me. You didn't. No, I love you. I don't want you to vomit in the middle of the night. And therefore, I'm going to hold it back. A poor person comes to the door. You want to give him. You love him. You want to give him $1,000,000. But that's not going to be good if you give him $1,000,000. You can't give him $1,000,000. So you give him a check for $18. And you know, have a nice day. I had to restrict. Or if I give you all, I have nothing left for myself. So there's got to be, but very important. Now, when we talk about body parts, whoa, that's another part. Kesa is the crown. Chachma is the right side of the brain. That's where the real raw chachma comes. And Bina is the left side of the brain. That's where you're able to develop things a little bit more. Okay, so now what part of the body represents chesed? The right hand. Why the right hand? Well, because you do things with the right hand. Gvura is the left hand, mystically. It's all from the Zohar. Well, why is it that way? Why is kindness the right hand and gvura the left hand? Why don't we switch it? What's the answer? Generally speaking, what is the stronger arm for 95% of people in the world? Let's just show. How many people here are righties? Okay, it's almost everyone in the world. Almost. There's some lefties, but a righty is the dominant. So now, what's more important, to be dominant with chesed or dominant with control? Chesed. So therefore, the right hand, which is your stronger hand, should be giving. Talmud says one should always bring people close with the right hand and push away with the left. Because sometimes you have to push away a little bit. If you're always bringing close, the person will start taking advantage of you and will not respect you. So you have to have a little distance. So when you push with the left. So therefore, this is a beautiful combination of the right hand. So now we're going to begin to remember now in our bodies, the three brain parts over here, right? And then the right hand and the left hand. So what's left for us to discuss? The second day of creation, correct? Mm-hmm. Where am I? Before millennial calendar. Where did I go? Oh, here we go. Second day of creation. Is Gvura, what did God do? He separated the higher waters from the lower waters. Now, just the idea of separation, what does that take? Gvura, it takes a power to say, this water goes till this amount and no further, right? So, and it's separated by the firmament. So water, what does water signify, as we said already?
Torah.
Kindness, Torah, but it's kindness, it's life. The separation of the waters means that the infinite chesed of God, which is called the higher waters, because that's on top over there, was separated by the lower waters, signifying what's below is a finite kindness, which has the ability to permeate the lower worlds and to benefit the lower. If the higher waters were coming down now, we'd be finished. So God says that kindness, I'm going to restrict, that water is for another realm. But down here, we can give you the lower waters and that lower ability to enjoy the kindness of Hashem in a restricted way. So therefore, let's see if we can quickly, without looking at your notes or looking over there. No, that doesn't work. Okay, so what did God create on the first day of creation?
Light.
Light. Okay, what element is light?
Fire.
Fire, right? Okay, what's the sphera of the first day? Chesed. What showed Hashem's chesed? The fact that he created the light, and there's what the human beings can receive. Okay, what did God create on the second day? What did he do on the second day? He separated the higher waters from the lower waters. Why? It's a day of water, correct? They have water. It's a day of gvura, control, and he showed that control. Oh, one more thing. What happened the first 1,000 years of creation? Was what? Kindness. People got away with murder. Yes, there was an Adam, the light of the world. So now what's the second millennia going to be? Now it's going to be judgment and discrimination. Now you're going to see God's gvura. So what happens in the second millennia? The flood. As a matter of fact, 300 years, I believe, before the flood, God made a mini flood that wiped out a third of the world. We don't know about that, but a mini flood, okay? But the flood wiped out everything, only sparing. God was discriminating. He was showing his control, restrictive power. He destroys the world, yet saves Noah. And then the world still is misbehaving, the Tower of Babel. Boom! He knocks them out again. Now you see God's judgment of the second millennia of history. Only one thing I forgot to mention is why we, Monday and Thursday are water days. Why is it Monday and Thursday? We read the Torah on Monday and Thursday. Why? Because Monday and Thursday are water days. And what's the Torah? Water. You don't go 3 days without water. Monday's a water day. Thursday's a water day. And Shabbos is a spiritual day. And that's why we read the Torah on those 3 days. That was the beginning. I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll continue this theme next week, God willing. Again, please just send